I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Before Harriet Tubman led slaves to freedom on the Underground Railroad and Frederick Douglass became an outspoken abolitionist leader, Ona Judge fled slavery and Philadelphia to live in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. She was one of the Washington slaves who lived in the presidential mansion in Philadelphia when this city was the nation's capital. She was born at Mount Vernon, one of several hundred slaves, and became Martha Washington's personal servant. When the Washingtons moved to Philadelphia, Ona Judge no doubt saw free blacks for the first time and was certainly aware of the growing abolitionist movement. George Washington organized several manhunts after Ona Judge escaped and spent years, really the rest of his life, trying to bring back his runaway property to no avail. Our guest, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, writes about this extraordinary story in her new book, Never Caught. It's also about our first president as a slaveholder. He did free his slaves after his death. Martha Washington did not. Erica Armstrong Dunbar is the Blue and Gold Distinguished Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Congratulations on your book, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't I know? Why don't we know more about Ona Judge?
You know, that's a question I ask myself 20-some-odd years ago when I first encountered her in the archives, and I was at around the corner at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania looking through old newspapers, and I came across this advertisement about a woman named Oney Judge. They call it, and typically you'll see her name written as Oney, but I argue that that's the diminutive of her name, sort of little Oney. And I choose to call her Ona, which is the name she went by at the end of her life. But yes, this is a sort of a hidden story, and one that took a good deal of time to recover.
We were talking about this before going on the air, but you wrote about someone who was a fugitive, who clearly not only was she a slave, but also a fugitive, not wanting to be found, making it harder, I'm assuming, for a historian to try to figure out what her life was about and who she was.
Exactly. I sort of, when I first started working on the project, I said, why has no one written a book about Ona? There'd been a few chapters here and there or an article, but no book based solely upon her life. And then as I started digging, I realized why. It's it took a great deal of time to sort of pull at the threads of her story because, as you said, she was a fugitive. And it's a fugitive's main priority to remain undetected. And she pretty much does that for most of her life as a fugitive.
She was born in 1773. As you write, her father was a white servant working at Mount Vernon, her mom a black slave, a woman named Betty. Mm-hmm. What do we know, or what can we extrapolate about, can I use the word relationship, what this was about?
Yeah, we know that Ona's born sometime between 73 and 74, so right during this kind of revolutionary moment. We don't know the exact date because Washington and many others who owned slaves did not keep records of birth dates. We know that her father was Andrew Judge, a white indentured servant who had actually made his way to Baltimore, and Washington had purchased his indenture agreement. And so while the majority of laborers at Mount Vernon were enslaved, there were some white indentured servants, and one of them was Andrew Judge. He was a tailor and responsible for making some of the more important outfits for George Washington. And Ona's mother was a woman named Betty, sometimes referred to as Mulatto Betty, and she was a seamstress. So their trades, their responsibilities would have put them in close proximity to one another. And what I say in the book is we don't exactly know the nature of their, we'll use the term relationship. Yeah. We don't know.
It doesn't feel quite right, but,
right.
But we'll,
we know that
it's a placeholder,
exactly,
I guess.
A placeholder that that is a marker that we just simply don't know if their relationship was consensual or if it wasn't. Because we know that slavery was really based upon rape and forced breeding, that, you know, we don't know. What we do know is that she does receive his last name.
Yes.
And there are very few who are enslaved at Mount Vernon who have a surname, and George Washington records her as such, Oney Judge.
What was it like to be then a little girl, an enslaved little girl, growing up at Mount Vernon.
Yeah. I think there's a part in the book where I sort of talk about the lives of enslaved children. I think oftentimes we don't really think about what it means to be a kid and enslaved. And for Ona, she would have been left really pretty much with other children under the care of an enslaved woman who was no longer deemed fit to work either in the house or agricultural work. But her childhood is short, mm-hmm. as was the childhoods of all other enslaved children. At the age of 10, she's called up to the Mansion House to serve Martha Washington and to do the sort of typical responsibilities of those that we call house slaves or the enslaved who work, do in a kind of domestic capacity. And what I wanted to do with this book is to attempt to kind of break down the myths around what it meant to be a quote, house slave.
Yeah, and she was a seamstress, I guess, like her mother and I guess like her father as well. Do we know how Martha Washington treated her slaves?
Well, one of the things, Martha leaves very little in the way of documentation. She burns all of her letters between George Washington and herself after George dies. I think there are three or four letters that survived. So she was very sort of careful about sort of revealing her innermost feelings. We do know that she was around her slaves quite frequently in the house, and that she, while she didn't necessarily receive a reputation for being an extremely harsh or physically punishing woman, she definitely had her ideas about enslaved mm-hmm. people, and they were different from her husband.
But they were inferior. I mean, that those clearly, kinds of ideas
that they were inferior, and that there were that certain slaves were more appropriate for working within the household. She preferred lighter complected enslaved women and men to work in the house. She believed that was physically more attractive, and that there was an intellectual gain for these folks that because they were of mixed race, mixed white ancestry, they were more intelligent.
Well, I would think someone that was a house slave, then you do get to observe up close the people who own you, how they live, their mm-hmm. visitors, perhaps their spats, their mm-hmm. relationship, what that life is about.
Yeah, you see it all. And I think Ona clearly sees it all from the age of 10 up through her early adulthood. And, you know, I think it reminds us that there's an institution of slavery, but then there's the kind of personal, intimate relationships and interactions that happen between those who are called owners right. and those who are the enslaved. And so Martha Washington, her life and what happened within the walls of Mount Vernon and later on in the president's house, all of that Ona saw.
Yeah.
She knew. She knew her mistress well.
How about the treatment of slaves that worked the plantation, that worked Mount Vernon?
Yeah. And so, you know, and I see this in the book. While George Washington doesn't receive this kind of reputation for being a sort of terribly demanding or physically punishing slave owner, he does, you know, there's letters and correspondence that goes back and forth between his manager, his estate manager, where he does say, hey, you know, if Charlotte does refuse to act appropriately, then, you know, correction is needed.
Mm-hmm. And meaning a beating?
Of course, a beating, a whipping. And the estate manager said, you know, I'll break her back. I'll, you know, so it was very clear that while George Washington didn't necessarily enforce this with his own hand, he did believe that correction was required.
One can assume that Ona Judge observed some of this.
Sure.
Even if she was living in the house or working in the house, that she observed the mistreatment of slaves, the physical punishment of slaves.
Certainly. I mean, I think it only, you know, it doesn't even take a sort of visual encounter with the horror of the abuse that enslaved people witness, felt every day. You hear about it. You hear that Jemmy or Bob was whipped. you know this, you hear about it, and it becomes a part of that fear that controls you, right? And so that you work as best you can to remain undetected, if not become the sort of favored enslaved person of George or Martha Washington. So she would have seen it and most certainly would have heard about it.
And if you ran away from Mount Vernon mm-hmm. in Virginia, what was the treatment? What was the punishment?
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, folks did run away. Enslaved people did run away. And George Washington advertised for his runaways during the colonial period. But what we know is that many who ran off didn't run off permanently. So there were these sort of episodic breaks where because of some specific reason, an anger or being upset, people took to the woods or really to the swamps and stayed as long as they could. And sometimes Washington would he'd put out an advertisement and sort of knowing that they would return eventually. And of course, they were corrected. But the idea of a sort of permanent escape, that becomes, I think, more and more uncomfortable for George Washington, especially around this moment of the Revolution, because a good number of his enslaved men and women ran off to fight with the British to look for freedom.
Which is all part of this complicated history. And it's so interesting. We spent so much time arguing about Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. and his slaves, obviously, because of Sally Hemings, but also because of what he wrote about freedom and liberty sure. and all of that. Do you think George Washington has been gotten off the hook when it comes to slavery? I didn't quite put that right.
Yeah, no, I think in some ways he has gotten a bit of a, maybe not a pass, but we've been quick to recognize the fact that he did, at the end of his life, make the decision to emancipate his enslaved men and women upon the death of his wife. And so I think that piece of his will protected him from kind of thinking about what slavery really meant at Mount Vernon while he was alive.
Yeah. But obviously, and there's a whole sort of complicated story that we will certainly get to. But is this book do you see this as a corrective for George Washington?
You know, I actually wrote the book not necessarily thinking about it as a corrective for Washington, but more a recovery of the work of African-American women's history. And George Washington happens to be one of the central characters here. If it does offer or serve as a corrective, that's great. But the main goal was to fill in the lives about Black women.
Well, we will pick up on that after this very short break. That's Erica Armstrong Dunbar, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we're talking about her new book. It's called Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And there's a big part of the story that happens here in Philadelphia. And our guest is a professor at the University of Delaware, and her specialty is really looking at the lives of African-American women, and particularly African-American women who lived under enslavement. To join our conversation, call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more of this story after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar about a woman named Ona Judge who escaped from the Washingtons when they lived here in Philadelphia, when Philadelphia was the nation's capital. She managed to escape and ended up living the rest of her life in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, of all places. Well, let's talk a little bit about what it was like for, I guess, slaves to move from Mount Vernon to Philadelphia. Philadelphia becomes the nation's first capital. Yeah. Ona Judge and some others are brought to this city. Some others, Hercules and others that we have heard about, brought to this city. And I'm trying to imagine being a slave at Mount Vernon in Virginia and then coming to Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think it's one of the great things about Ona's life is that we get to see the beginnings of this new nation through the eyes of the enslaved. And that's, I think, super important. Typically, we see it through the eyes of those who own slaves. And so in 1789, George Washington, actually, they moved first to New York, where he takes the oath of office alone. Martha Washington was unhappy about the move north and took her time packing things and
sounds
preparing
kind of familiar,
to
go. Doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Thinking Melania Trump here,
a little
but
bit
go
of time.
Ahead.
And so what they decide to do, or what Martha and George decide, is that they are going to take a little bit of home with them when they go to New York. And they take seven enslaved men and women, and Ona is one of them. So five men, two women. And, you know, there's reports about that scene when they leave Mount Vernon, and that the enslaved and Martha Washington were, it was reported, greatly agitated. And I say in the book, you know, that it was her family, Ona's family, that was greatly agitated about her leaving. She was 16 years old, and she was leaving her family for the first time, moving hundreds of miles away to New York. And arrives in New York. She's the one benefit was that she traveled with her brother, Austin, who served as a waiter for the Washingtons. But she really, life changed immediately. Not only was she leaving home, but now she was serving really the most powerful family in New York, in the North, and moving from a slaveholding South to a state, to New York, that was beginning to really start to emancipate, to free Black people. They're there for a relatively short period of time and then come to Philadelphia. And it's here that Ona witnesses, I argue in the book, it's here where she sees freedom, really Black freedom, for the first time. And it changes her.
Well, she's an urban slave. So she's still a slave, even though she's living in Pennsylvania with the Washingtons. You describe her as a bondwoman. Mm-hmm. How much freedom did she have, you think, to walk the streets, to talk to people?
Yeah,
maybe even talk to free Black people.
Yeah, it was, with the nation's capital moving to Philadelphia, it kind of put George Washington in a tricky space. The number of enslaved people were upped to 9 in Philadelphia. And he had to kind of walk carefully. He understood that Philadelphia, Pennsylvania as a state, had already begun to dismantle slavery. And so the laws had started the work of creating a free Black population. And so when Ona arrives, she sees free Black people selling pepper pot soup in the streets and selling oysters and fresh fruits. And she watches Richard Allen and Mother Bethel be created around the corner just about. And so it's really here that for the first time, Ona's in the minority in terms of being an enslaved person.
Oh.
That, you know, the majority of Philadelphia, of Black Philadelphia, was free by the late 1790s. And so the president and Martha Washington have to sort of tread lightly. They understand that freedom was contagious. After all, you know, they just fought a war about it.
With the mother country.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But George Washington, and I guess we can include Martha as well, and essentially they had to break Pennsylvania law, or certainly push the law, skirt the law, in order to be able to keep slaves in Philadelphia. How did they do that?
Yeah, this the law in Pennsylvania stated, it was a gradual emancipation law that March 1st, 1780 stated that you could only be held as an enslaved person up to your 28th birthday. And one of the other pieces of this law was that if you were a non-resident, if you came from outside of the state of Pennsylvania and you brought your enslaved property with you, they could only be kept in the state for up to 6 months. And if you stepped over that time period, longer than 6 months, they would had the right to be emancipated. So George and Martha Washington quickly were made aware of this law and had to sort of scramble to figure out how to keep their enslaved people from Mount Vernon with them in a free, basically what was a free Black Philadelphia. And so I argue they don't break the law, but they break the spirit of the law.
Sure.
Most certainly they stretch it. And they create a plan to basically rotate their slaves in and out of the state, sending them back to Virginia. And if that wasn't possible every 6 months, then to go for a quick river crossing to Trenton, to basically hit reset and to start the clock of slave ownership over again and to not lose their property.
Did they do this secretly or did they do this more overtly? Because it seems to me if they did it secretly, that they knew that they were, or he knew, he was breaking the law.
It was definitely done in secret.
Yeah, and he broadcast it.
Yeah, no, he didn't broadcast. He actually writes to Tobias Lear's secretary. He says that, you know, I'd prefer to do this discreetly to deceive the public if necessary.
Is that a quote?
Yeah. So he says, I prefer only you, Martha, my wife, and I to know what's happening. So, but even though they try very hard to keep this a secret from the gaze of the greater public, the slaves at the president's house, they knew what was happening. They most certainly knew. And they also knew the stories of others who had taken advantage of this kind of 6-month window. And Washington knew this. He was treading on thin ice.
Well, there was Reverend Richard Allen. Mm-hmm. There was Absalom Jones. There were white abolitionists certainly in the city as well. Was this a hotbed of abolitionism at this time?
Yeah, it was, I'd say, the early days. They weren't necessarily calling themselves abolitionists, but they believed in black freedom. And the Pennsylvania Abolition Society was founded and helped people who were wrongfully held as slaves and others who had attempted to escape. You know, there was a network of community folks, black and white, who were willing to help and move the agenda along of black freedom. And so it's more than fortuitous that Ona ends up in this hotbed of black activism and freedom.
So even if she wasn't either allowed or wasn't talking to free black people on the street, she certainly, especially if she's working in the house when she was, you're going to hear all of this,
sure,
right?
Sure. And she's, you know, it's almost impossible at that point in time for her to not encounter free black people. You know, enslaved people were the minority. So when she went out with Martha Washington on social calls or wherever, she would encounter free blacks and, I argue, free white. So to talk about kind of what white servitude or owning your ability to choose who you work for, that influences her as well.
Yeah. You write, so men and women, free and enslaved, lived in close proximity to one another at 190 High Street. This is in Philadelphia. The president failed to realize how such tight quarters would jeopardize his fortune. So the fact that they were living so close together, as you were just saying, they're slaves had to overhear.
Sure.
They had to know what was going on.
Sure.
They maybe get that little taste of freedom.
To get the taste of freedom. And also we know that at least one of the enslaved people at the president's house, Christopher Shields, he was literate. So he could read the paper. You know, these are things you just needed one person to be able to read. And then, you know, the story's up. So aside from the constant conversation, reading the newspapers, these folks knew that there was a possibility of freedom in Philadelphia, but they were caught in this web, this bind, that their owner was not some unknown guy, right? He was the most powerful, prominent American of the moment, and it would not be easy to run away from him, and not only to run away, but to remain away. That is, you know, that's the other part of the story.
You had mentioned that earlier, that people would run away from Mount Vernon, but then might come back. So the idea of running away and staying away is a whole other way of thinking about being a fugitive.
Yeah, it is. It's this not necessarily thinking about permanent freedom or some attempt at finding freedom. But, you know, I think as the century wears on, that the stakes become higher and higher as Washington is a very high profile person. And, you know, there was always the concern that if you attempted to run away and if you were unsuccessful, that your punishment could be the auction block. So it wasn't simply, you know, just having to withstand maybe a beating, which is horrendous in itself. But the idea of being separated from friends and family, that stopped people in their tracks.
And that is Erica Armstrong Dunbar. We're talking about her new book. It's called Never Caught, subtitled The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And she is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. She's written other books as well. And she has a particular area of expertise in the experiences of Black women. And you can join our conversation. Again, call or text our comment line. It's 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, getting a history lesson, a very important history lesson, I should say, in this hour of Radio Times. There's a little section in here that I circled in that living in such close proximity could be dangerous for a woman like Ona Judge. And you talk about the kind of relative safety, I guess, that slaves felt when they had their own cabins, their own places to live. If they shared a house with their owners, a young woman like Ona Judge could be sexually assaulted.
Sure. It's, you know, like I said, one of the things that I wanted really to do with Ona's story and this book is to remind us of the dangers of life in the house, right? So oftentimes this image of, you know, lighter duties, supposedly, of domestic work made you a supposedly preferential slave. But I argue, you know, that to be in the house, that was work that was unyielding. You were on call all of the time, day or night. There was no place to go, to breathe, to live, to love, that you were basically almost a part of the furniture in the household. You were there and constantly available for your owner's needs. And so in addition, the president's house was packed with secretaries and servants and enslaved people. And this was never the best case scenario for a young woman who was basically on her own after 1794. Her brother dies, Austin dies. And so she has no family members there with her. And as I said before, we know that slavery was, for the most part, predicated upon sexual abuse. And this was something that Ona and other enslaved women worked to avoid to the best of their abilities.
You quote an author and fugitive slave, Harriet Jacobs, and here she is describing her encounters with her new owner. No matter whether the slave girl be as black as ebony or as fair as her mistress, in either case, there is no shadow of law to protect her from the insult, from violence, or even from death. All of these are inflicted by fiends who bear the shape of men. I mean, that is just haunting.
Yeah, it is. And it's the reality, the hard reality for those of us who do African-American women's history in particular. You know, it's traumatic going through the archives and reading the accounts and knowing what happened constantly. And Ona Judge most certainly was aware of this, was taught about this at an early age. Harriet Jacobs says, you know, they were told young what to expect and how to try and protect themselves.
Well, I mean, do we know if she ever was raped or sexually assaulted?
We don't know. I mean, she never comments upon it, and I wasn't able to find any archival information. Of course, people want to know. That's the first thing that usually people ask, given what we know about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. We don't have that. And at first, when I was writing the book, I kind of was like, well, I hope I find that piece of information. But the fact that I didn't actually, I think, makes the story more compelling, that Ona made a decision to run away, to fight for her, what she believed to be her right, freedom, without necessarily having this in the forefront of her mind. She may have been assaulted. She may not have been. I simply don't know.
It's interesting, and I don't want to give too much of the story away, but here we are, and she decides to run away, to run away from the President of the United States and his wife here in Philadelphia. You say because she was concerned that she might be sold to Martha given away
to a granddaughter.
To a granddaughter.
Yeah, she's. It's very clear. I mean, one of the great things about this story is that Ona leaves behind her own words through her testimony in interviews at the end of her life. And she makes it very clear that she finds out she's going to be given away to Martha Washington's granddaughter. And I think one thing that's important to remember is that technically Ona belonged to Martha Washington, right? She was what was called a dower slave. So while it was George Washington's responsibility to look after her, to make certain that the estate was kept intact. She was Martha's slave. And when Martha's granddaughter, Eliza Custis, made a decision to get married to some guy that folks didn't know, and he
Thomas
was older,
Law.
Thomas Law.
Seemed like the problem,
he
right?
He seemed, he was, there were concerns about him, not just that he was 20 years older than her, but that, you know, he had been in England a long time and in India, and then had come back from India to the United States with two of his biracial Indian children. Hmm. All of these things raised eyebrows, but more importantly, they didn't know that the engagement was so, that the involvement was serious. And so this, it turns into this engagement. Martha's concerned. They basically eventually say, okay, go get married. But Martha's worried, and she realizes that she's got to provide some kind of support for her granddaughter, and that would be to give Ono away.
As a wedding gift.
As a gift, yeah. That she was to be bequeathed. And for the grandchildren of the Washingtons, all of Martha Washington's children had died before really reaching middle adult age. And so it's really just her grandchildren who are left. And she looks to them as though they were her children. And, you know, Ona believed that she wasn't just going to be willed away once the Washingtons died, that she would be given away immediately. And because now Eliza would need to go off and have a family and would need help. And it was this was, I argue, the trigger that made Ona Judge realize this was my moment. If I go back to Virginia, and she writes this, you know, or rather says it. We know that Ona was illiterate, but she spoke this in an interview. She says, you know, I knew that if I went back to Virginia, I would never get my liberty. And so it's this moment that says, okay, now is the time. And she takes it. She takes that moment.
Gives me chills. Mm-hmm. Let's take another short break. That's Erica Armstrong Dunbar, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We've been telling this extraordinary story about one of George Washington's, Martha Washington's runaway slave, a woman named Ona Judge. And our guest book is called Never Caught. And again, you can call our comment line. You can also text us 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She is a distinguished professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, wrote a book called A Fragile Freedom, African-American Women and Emancipation in the Antebellum City, and her new book, again, called Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Ona runs away.
She does.
And George Washington posts a reward, an ad for her. Can you read it for us?
Sure. This advertisement appears May 25th, 1796, in a newspaper called Claypool's American Daily Advertiser. $10 reward. Absconded from the household of the President of the United States on Saturday afternoon, Oney Judge, a light mulatto girl, much freckled with very black eyes and bushy hair. She's of middle stature, but slender and delicately made, about 20 years of age. She has many changes of very good clothes of all sorts, but they are not sufficiently recollected to describe. As there was no suspicion of her going off, and it happened without the least provocation, it is not easy to conjecture whether she has gone or fully what her design is. But as she may attempt to escape by water, all matters of vessels and others are cautioned against receiving her on board, although she may, and probably will endeavor, to pass for a free woman. And it is said, has the wherewithal to pay her passage. $10 will be paid to any person, white or black, who will bring her home, if taken in the city or on board any vessel in the harbor, and a further reasonable sum if apprehended and brought home from a greater distance and in proportion to the distance.
Did George Washington write that?
Well, his steward wrote it. He gave direction for what the advertisement should say, but gave direction. And what we see is Ona runs away on Saturday, and by Monday there are advertisements for her in two newspapers, this newspaper as well as the Philadelphia Gazette, and they run for about a week.
Wow. Would this be a quote-unquote typical ad for a fugitive slave?
Yeah, somewhat typical. I think one of the things that struck me about this ad in particular was the fact that it basically made an overture to the black community. It said any person, right, white or black, would be paid $10. And halfway through the week, we see that language start to disappear from the ad. And we're not certain if it's very clear that the black community won't help in this effort. But the advertisements are slightly different. But clearly for a week, they're advertising for her.
Is $10 a lot of money at that time?
$10, it will buy you a barrel of flour. So I wanted readers to know. I looked through the newspapers and said, okay, what do you buy? What do you get for $10? A barrel of flour.
She ends up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Now, was that a place where fugitive slaves would go? Or was that just by accident?
Yeah, it's, when I first started this project, I thought, Portsmouth, that's an interesting location. Typically, we think of places like Philadelphia, New York, Boston, as the kind of typical usual suspects or places you'll go that a fugitive would go. And for Ona, you know, she ran into some very serious difficulties, which is that she lived in New York. She was a recognizable face in New York, and she would most certainly have been spotted faster than other locales. And the same may have been true for Boston, although she didn't live there. There were a lot of associates of the Washingtons there. But she actually says in her interview that she doesn't know where she's going to actually go when she makes this decision to run, that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that help her.
Yeah.
And that they don't tell her where she's going, which made a lot of sense. They wanted to protect themselves and in some ways to protect her. So she doesn't know until right before she leaves that she's going to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
And that's what, a little village, a kind of a seaport village
it's
or growing
seaport
village?
Town. Yeah, it's a growing seaport town for the 18th century. So, and also one that had sort of direct transportation from Philadelphia. And so one of the things I was able to do was to actually track the ship that Ona ran off, that she used to be ferried to her relative freedom.
And did the captain of that ship know who was on board? Do we
yeah,
know?
We don't know. She actually, in her interview, she was very careful to not name names, but she, you know, she's protecting these folks. It's a federal law, federal crime to break this law of helping a fugitive. And she does name the captain of her ship, John Bowles. And we don't know if he was an abolitionist or what have you, but we do know that he was willing to at least turn a blind eye to maybe what was a somewhat unusual passenger.
You write that George Washington, almost until his death, was determined to bring back Ona Judge.
Yeah.
Was this personal for him? It's sort of a weird way to put it.
Yeah, but no, I think there were multiple reasons for this kind of dogged pursuit. And he does technically pursue her until just a couple months before his death. There's correspondence about attempting to getting her back. You know, I think part of this is about controlling your estate and your property, and for all slaveholders, having a slave run off was never a good sign about your ability to control your people, right? Mm-hmm. I think that Martha Washington was very involved in this attempt. And he says as much, right? In his correspondence, he says, oh, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again. She needs her, you know. And so there's definitely anger there from Martha Washington, this feeling of being betrayed, of not believing. And then at one point believing that perhaps she was wooed away by some...
A Frenchman, right?
A great
of course.
Person to tag it, right, at that moment. That there was no way that Ona could have been the architect of her own escape. And what we know later on is that
actually was just so not true.
Well, in fact, you quote this guy named Whipple, mm-hmm. who goes as one of the people to go to try to convince Ona to come back. He's quoted as saying, she expressed great affection and reverence for her master and mistress and without hesitation declared her willingness to return and to serve with fidelity during the lives of the president and his lady if she could be freed on their decease should she outlive them. Now, the question is, did she really say that? But here she is, at least according to Whipple, negotiating her return or not.
It's, it's like, okay, here's a 22-year-old enslaved black woman negotiating through the customs collector, Whipple, with the president of the United States. And the president is appalled when he realizes that this is a negotiation. It wasn't supposed to be that. It was supposed to be a mission that recovered his property right. or his wife's property. And it turned into something very different. And I think that speaks to what the feeling of officials and citizens of New Hampshire felt about slavery and also the free black community in Portsmouth that wanted to protect her.
Let me play someone who called into our comment line. This is Cheryl, and let's listen.
My name is Cheryl, calling from Westchester. My daughters are half African American, and when they were little, we went to Pensbury Manor in Pennsylvania, and the guide explained that George Washington had slaves, and she justified it by saying that he had to, the whole country needed slavery to prosper and to avoid embarrassing my children. I said nothing.
I appreciate that call. That raises a whole host of questions. I was talking to you before going on the air, going to Monticello a couple of years ago. I'm not seeing much evidence of Sally Hemings there.
Yeah, I think that I'm encouraged because there is more talk about slavery. Right now at Mount Vernon, there's a new exhibit about George Washington and slavery. And I'm not certain that that exhibit would have been there 30 years ago. I think that many have rested on this conversation. Well, George Washington was a man of his times, or people owned slaves. But Washington, over time, he changed. And in some ways, I'm hoping that through this book, people see him in a different light. They see how his feelings about slavery definitely softened throughout the course of his life, enough so that at the end, he made the decision, I will emancipate my slaves upon the death of Martha. Now, it's important to note, he wouldn't do that while he was alive. He was not willing to live without the luxury of the wealth that came with his over 100 enslaved people. And even for Martha, who owned more slaves than he was not willing to leave her without that. One of the things I do put forward is that George Washington had no biological children. And I wonder if he would have been so quick to dismantle his inheritance, to emancipate a great deal of wealth, had he had sons or daughters to pass them to.
Well, that's a very provocative thing to think about. Mm-hmm. He did sign the Fugitive Slave Act.
He did. So in Washington, kind of straddles.
For those of us that have a rusty memory about what that act was about.
So in 1793, he signs this law, which basically gives slaveholders the right to pursue their human property across state lines and gives basically federal teeth or enforcement to this. There are magistrates that would have to be involved and attorneys and all a process basically was put in place to reclaim your slaves who had run off. So while he's sort of dealing with his concerns or misgivings about slavery, he is still very much acting as a Virginian and as a slaveholder. And when it comes to the law, when we look at his record of law and his actions, he was pro-slavery. In his death, or after his death, there was a sort of different turn to the story.
Ona lives about 50 years, I guess, beyond this, when she leaves or escapes from the Washington's house and lives pretty much the rest of her life in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I wanted to we often remember her as Washington's or Martha Washington's escaped slave, but it's important to note she spent a half a century on her own. And, I made the decision. I didn't want to use the term kind of free or freedom in the title because the reality was she was never free.
Right. She was always a fugitive.
Always a fugitive. She was simply never caught. And I think that what the latter part of her life does is show us the difficulties of simply being a person of African descent at this moment. Whether you were enslaved, fugitive, or free, your life was fragile. And as we've seen from other narratives like Solomon Northup, and we have 12 Years a Slave, he was a free man who was kidnapped and spent a horrific 12 years enslaved, that it makes us ask the question, okay, what does it really mean to have a free North? Yeah. What is freedom when there is slavery in a nation? How free is free? How fragile and vulnerable were free blacks, enslaved blacks, and those who were making their way out of slavery in the North during this time period? It's complicated, it's vulnerable, it's fragile, and we see that in how Ona lives the rest of her life.
She does marry a sailor, Jack Staines.
Yeah.
They have a couple of kids.
They do.
They all die before she does, right?
Well, we have she lives a very kind of difficult life. The life
they're
of
poor, right?
They're desperately poor. And but I think what's so important is that in Ona's words, she would do it again. You know, she didn't regret a moment of it. She gave away the fancy dresses and perhaps the extra food that she received working for the Washingtons for the life that she chose, to be as free as possible, right? To live, to choose a mate, to raise her children. These were things that were never promised to anyone enslaved in Virginia and would likely not have happened here in Portsmouth. And then later on, Greenland, where she runs to a couple miles outside of Portsmouth, she's able to do that.
She was interviewed in 1846. I just want to read one or two sentences from this where she's talking about her life. I guess this is the reporter saying, Ona says, or she says, that the stories told of Washington's piety and prayers, so far as she ever saw or heard while she was his slave, have no foundation. Card playing and wine drinking were the business at his parties, and he had more of such company Sundays than on any other day.
Yes.
So these people living with their owners the house got to see everything.
And think about that. I also believe that had a lot to do with why the Washingtons were so kind of relentless in their pursuit. Ona knew a lot. She lived with them during very difficult moments and at the beginning of his presidency. And for a man who was concerned about his legacy, he made the decisions to try to go after her, to break the law, to not follow the rules of the fugitive slave law, to try and do it deceptively. As he wrote, as least expensively as possible. He was cash strapped always. But he wanted to do this and to not cause a fuss because he was getting ready to leave office. And he cared about his image and his reputation. So he pursued her while he was still the president and then as a private citizen.
Yeah. Almost out of time here. The book is written. Do you miss her or does she kind of live in you, mm-hmm. with you?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. People ask or say that they're so excited about this story, about this book, and I am too, but there is a little bit of sadness, sort of. I compare it to when your child goes off to college and you have to let them go. You know, I've let Ona go to the world, and I'm just really happy and hoping that we know her name the way we know a Frederick Douglass, the way we know a Harriet Tubman. She deserves it. And so it's been an honor and my duty to do this.
Well, a great honor for us as well to have you on Radio Times. It's a terrific book. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. The book, Never Caught, The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And again, our guest is Distinguished Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.